This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I am going to be talking to Stephen Hunter about his 10th Bob Lee Swager novel called G-Man. It's a very retro book, going back all the way to 1934 to talk about the beginning of the Swager family. And for anyone who loves the new television program, The Shooter, of course, you know that Stephen Hunter is the inspiration. His first book is the inspiration for that series. And so I'm excited that I will be able to talk to Stephen at the bottom of the hour. But right now, I'm going to a very interesting author whose book came out. I'm just holding it up to the camera for those of you who are seeing it on podcast. And it's called There's More Than One Way Home, and it's by Donna Levin. Hi, Donna, are you there?
Hello, I am here.
Okay, do you pronounce it Levin?
Yes, Levin. Levin.
Oh, okay, good, because I get so many names with... And I get Levines and Levines and okay.
Then, yes.
Levin. Okay. Well, Donna, it's so nice to welcome you to Joy on Paper and to talk today about this book of yours. Of course, May is a national sort of mental health month, and I thought it was appropriate that we would talk today about your book because in it, of course, your main character suffers from
Asperger's syndrome.
Asperger's syndrome, and so this is sort of an appropriate time. But this book is not just about a disability. This book is also it's a very interesting and fascinating mix. It has it's a mystery. There's a mystery. There's a lot about sort of a social, the society in general, and the reaction of people to disabilities. And, of course, there's also a love story intermixed with all of this. So tell us about the idea, how the idea came to you and a little bit about the story.
Well, it came to me somewhat indirectly from what you see on the page because I've been a writing instructor for many years as well, and two books about the craft of writing that were published by Writer's Digest Books. And I often, in my workshops, talked about the element of setting in a novel, which is the time and place in which the story unfolds and you know, how that affects the character's goals and what the character's values are. And I would often illustrate that element by saying that it took the story of Anna Karenina, and if she'd been born 150 years later in San Francisco, and she was unhappily married, well, she would have gotten a divorce. No one would have thought any less of her for it. She could have moved to Marin County and started her own line of activewear called Anna! Exclamation point. But one night it occurred to me, what if I wrote that novel? Anna Karenina set in modern times. Of course, events would unfold very differently. And in the process of writing that, it occurred to me, why wasn't she getting a divorce? Well, what if she and her husband had a child on the autism spectrum? And I do have a son on the autism spectrum. He's in his 20s now, and he's a wonderful young man. In There's More Than One Way Home, my character, Anna Kagan, has a 10-year-old on the autism spectrum. And that was, like a lot of writers, you know, I wanted to write about my own experiences. I didn't want to write a memoir. I'm not a memoirist. My life has not been that interesting. But I wanted to write about that experience. And sadly, about some of the, not to put the final point on it, hostility that other parents, more than other kids, have towards a kid who's different. You know, anyone who saw Big Little Lies on HBO recently will see some of that played out. While I was watching Big Little Lies, I kept thinking, gee, these kids are being mean to this other kid. What if that kid actually had a reason to be mean? It's not the kids who are so mean to the other kid. It's the parents who don't want to be tainted with the relationship with a kid who's different. The kid might be dangerous. My book is set in 2004. And one reason I said it then was because there was so much less known about the autism spectrum, even 13 years ago, than there is now. So much less written about it, so much less drama with children like this. And even now, there's still a surprising amount of, well, frankly, ignorance and intolerance. But things have changed much, much, much for the better. Now, if you talk about the autism spectrum, people know what you're talking about often anyway. We've got to get a hold of the few people who don't and educate them as well. So that was the two directions that the book came from, both Anna Karenina and my own experiences as a mom. And I got this kind of a little bit of a hybrid book. It's not a mystery for the devout mystery fan.
No, but it has enough of a story in there that it is intriguing.
Well, I hope so. Somebody said, I can't find who, even on the internet, somebody said that every good novel is a mystery. I want to say Fitzgerald, but the internet is not helping me out with this one. So I certainly hope the story is enough to keep people reading and about the characters and coming to care about the characters, because, you know, that's what writing is all about. You know, you come for the story and you think about it later because of the characters, I think.
Well, it's true. And in Anna's case, of course, she is in a position where she has a nice life and a rich husband. And then with this situation that develops with her son, you're right that back in those days, we're thinking now, what, 13 years ago, people really didn't know. And I know from my experience in working in Sunday schools that people didn't understand the problems. And it's been really heartwarming how things have changed over just, I had been working in this Sunday school since about 13 years, and the difference and the difference in the staff, their relationship to children within the autism spectrum, and also with the children, how absolutely wonderful I am finding that the other children are. They really, that terrible hostility that, of course, you write about in your book, and cruelty, I mean, just horrible cruelty, that I've been really very, I don't know, encouraged by that people can change because of just what I've seen in Sunday school.
Yes, and again, I think at the risk of generalizing, but the hostility as there has been has come more from the parents than the kids. At least that was my experience. And hostility, even that's too strong a word in terms of my own real life experience. It's kind of the birthday party invitations don't come. You find out there's been a birthday party and, you know, your kid was the one not invited. And, you know, things like that are kind of are painful. But the whole culture has changed so much in terms of inclusiveness. I should say when my son started elementary school, kindergarten, he was in only the second year of a full inclusion program. And this was my God, God help me, it was about 20 years ago now. Now it's just taken for granted that a lot of kids with a lot of differences are going to be in that class. And of course, I also wanted to write about Anna Kagan and what happens to a woman who married too young and then meets the love of her life. And as much as things have changed in that area, you still have this choice between, oh my God, this is my soulmate, and oh my God, this is my husband and the father of my child. And now that the sexual revolution is over, there's still a certain amount of drama that inheres in a situation like that. And how we idealize somebody we just met, how romance has to turn into daily life, and that isn't always easy in a relationship. So those were all things I hope to write about, you know, within the story, and of course without being preachy. But you know, of course, as you know, you start writing, and the story starts to take you where you didn't expect to go, as I've heard you discuss with other authors.
Well, that's sort of the magic of being a writer, that the characters sometimes do take over, and they have almost a life of their own. They know where they're going to be going, and you have to sort of lead the way. And it's a fun experience, isn't it?
You know, I think most writing is really hard, but what you just described, that's the fun, is that surprise when you think, oh my God, where did this come from? Then, of course, the next really hard thing is when you have to cut out large pieces because they were taking it the wrong way, or because they don't work, or because the editor says no, 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 and you finally realize that the editor is right. It's like, wait, I spent so much time on this pages, and there's this really good joke in there. And that's really difficult. To tell you the truth, there's more than one way home. There's as many pages as you might be holding in your hand. There's at least that many pages in the recycling bin. Ouch.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. I was talking, I was invited to speak to a group of young writers, and I mentioned that, you know, that this will happen to you. You will submit your book, and if you are fortunate enough to find an agent who will take it on and is interested in it, you have to be prepared to for changes and for editing. And it's always funny when the sort of clicks, you can see it in their eyes. They're thinking like, oh my, is that real? I mean, I really have to change things. And, you know, I don't want anyone to tell me what to do. And I said, well, you know, it's not that they tell you what to do, but because of their experience, they know what will work, and they're reading it from a different perspective. They're reading it from a reader's perspective, you know, not from the writer's perspective. And
what I've told students at times is that, you know, the reader is not your therapist, and the reader is not your friend. If you just wanted to put down everything you wanted to put down, you'd keep a journal. But you're trying to communicate something, and that's hard. Well, the big thing is that's really easy for me to say, and it's a lot harder for me to do. Even towards the end, there were things that I thought, no, 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 I really want to keep this. No, no, I really want to keep this, because gosh darn it, the reader should appreciate how hard I worked on that paragraph, so it's got to stay. And I think most of that is gone. There may be a few paragraphs in there I'll even say that there's an episode where Anna and her quote-unquote friends are apartment hunting, and even now I think, I don't know that really needed to be in there for the story, but I really wanted readers to know how hard it is to find an apartment in San Francisco. So I left it in.
Okay, well, now all of the readers are going to be really intrigued by that little little idea, and they're going to have to read it just to find out if you really needed it or not. So that's a good thing.
So.
Yeah, that's fun. Now, of course, this is your third novel, right?
Yes, it is.
So, wow, how was it when you wrote your first novel? Did you have find a publisher easily, or an agent?
I'm glad you asked that question. I had written a novel that an agent was shopping and had not sold, although she hadn't sent it out a lot. But in retrospect, I don't think it was really ready to be published. And then I showed her the opening pages of what was actually my second novel, and an editor came by her office and read them, and it wasn't quite this simple, but essentially bought the novel based on those opening pages. And wow, that was really a gratifying experience and a lucky experience, and kind of spoiled me for things to come later, because not every book has been anywhere near that easy. I was able to write that first novel with a contract, and the other novels I have not written with a contract. With a contract is so much easier, because you know that people have editor is the publishing house has some motive to like it. They it's very unconscious, I think, but they.
Well, they're already they're validating your talent, and
yeah,
and they make you feel good. You know, really feel good.
And when you're writing something on spec, they have all the reason in the world. Anybody who sees has all the reason in the world just to say no. They've got such an incredibly high pile of things to look at that they're almost looking for reasons to say no to something, just to make the pile smaller. And I don't mean that as a criticism at all. I have a friend who works in HR, and he says he's got so many resumes, he's looking for a reason just to go through them and get to the next one. And he's looking for the one that he just can't find a reason to say no to. And that's hard when you're writing a resume, and it's at least as hard when you're writing a novel. So there's a lot of perseverance and days when you just crawl under the covers with a box of Godiva chocolate and say, why me? Poor me. Nobody understands me. And then you get up the next day and you go back to the computer.
Well, I think you've done a great job with this book. I think
thank you.
Anna is somebody I think that the reader can relate to and want to care about her. They want, you know, things to be better for her. And I like that. I like that what you've managed to do with her.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad. Of course, that's what one hopes. I wanted to mention before, actually, when we first started talking, that I think autism lit is a whole new genre of fiction. That's I'm waiting for Amazon to create that as a subcategory to their. They've got so many little categories and subcategories: coming of age and family life, and makeovers and. Coming of age with the subcategory, new bicycle, coming of age, bicycle stolen. But so where's the autism spectrum subcategory? I actually wrote to Amazon and suggested they add it. Funny thing, they didn't respond, but I think they're going to add this at some point, because you've got launched by Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, of course. This plethora, really, of books with characters on the spectrum now, and on television, too.
Exactly.
So,
don't lose faith. Amazon's algorithm will catch up to you eventually, because you don't actually talk to people at Amazon. The algorithm searches out until finally it says, okay, that's it. We need another category. I'm not sure if there's any humans behind it anymore, because they really have developed a fine tune on how they can search and find people, and they know what you like, and they know how many people like it. They're pretty clever like that.
Yeah, they certainly are. For the most part, I think it's great. Once in a while, it gets a little creepy, like when the ad turns. You're looking at something on the internet, and then the ad turns up for that item on your Facebook page or your
it happens
your
all
email.
The time now. It is creepy, but I do want to say that on the other hand, I don't think this book is at all limited to people who are interested in autism as a subject, because it's just woven in there as part of the plot of the story and of an event that begins the book and carries us through. So it's not that you have to be particularly interested in autism. any more than, you know, you had to be with of mice and men. You know, you didn't. Mm-hmm. It's just there. It's in the woven. If a book is done right and you did it right, it's not a preachy book about autism and, oh, well, you should be nice to kids with autism, you know, because that's not going to get you very far. Because, in fact, it is a story about Anna and her struggles and about the people around her. And that's what makes it a very readable book.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That's what keeps me going on the average day when I don't get to talk on radio and I just have to sit here with my cat. So thank you.
this program, I always encourage people to write. And since you have written two books about writing, mention them, because I know they are available on Amazon. What are the names of them?
Yes. Get That Novel Started was the first one, and available on Amazon. And the second one is Get That Novel Written, which was also available on Amazon.
Okay. So what's your advice? Get That Novel Written. What should people do?
Well, first of all, they have to write daily. And then you've got to find a really good supportive way to get feedback on your work. And that's not... not all feedback is created equal. You've got to find a group where people know what they're talking about, but also are being supportive. They're not trying to shut you down. So I'd start with a class rather than a peer group when you're starting out, with a good instructor. That's what got me started. And then as time goes by, you can even form your own peer group. But those are the two things. And then the first one, of course, is by far the most important. You just sit down and write. And doesn't matter what you write, just write something. It can be the lyrics to all the Beatles songs you remember. I'm dating myself here, but...
one thing, people, I always recommend they do Scrivener as a program for writers, because it's so nice that they have a target right there, an actual target, and you can put in how many words you're going to write every day, and... the target pops up, and you can see if you've met your target. So I enjoy Scrivener because it's a fun program for writers.
Oh, Scrivener's great. Yeah. A little bit of a learning curve, but once you get it's really, really good.
It makes your life much easier because you can organize everything so nicely. Actually, especially for nonfiction books, I think it's the best, because you can really move things around, and as you do when you're writing a nonfiction book, you have all these subjects, and then you want to move them around into the right things. Scrivener is perfect. So,
yeah.
Okay. Do you have a website you want people to come to?
I do. It is donalevin.com, just like my name.
Okay.
And, of course, there's a link there. You can go straight to Amazon, and they're fun algorithms. And there's more than one way home. And I sure would love to have people do that, although I'm more interested in readers than I am in sales. So if you buy it and share it with a friend, or borrow it from a friend, that's good too.
Well, I encourage people to buy. I'm a great believer in buying books. So
okay.
I want everyone to buy this book. That's what I want, because
that's really what I want.
That's we need to support authors and keep you going. And I think you've done a great job here, Donna, and I'm so pleased that I was able to speak to you today, and particularly in this month of May, when we're thinking about this subject. But as I think this book is a year-round book, and you can read it anytime, and I'll put it on my summer reading list for people so that they can also click on it and go to your website too, and see more about your work. And I just want
thank you.
I want to thank you for being on today. It's been fun.
No, I want to thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, you take care now, and we'll look forward to your next book, and you'll be back on Joy on Paper.
All right.
Okay. Bye for now. Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back.
is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
I stayed up all night reading this book. We can say that on your behalf to media and tastemakers, but it would be silly for you to brag on your own book. When you need a champion in your corner promoting your work, JKS Communications is with you every step of the way. We take care of the details of promoting you and your book so that you can spend your time and energy focusing on what you do best. Radio and TV interviews, newspaper features, book tours, social media, video. You can do it all, and we're here to make it happen. In 12 years, we've helped more than 700 authors and 1,200 books find their fan base. Everyone at JKS Communications loves what we do, and it shows in our enthusiasm. We're going to make a great team with you. Check us out at jkscommunications.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of My Pillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented My Pillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. My Pillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry My Pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose.
Mike is offering 50% off his 4-pack special.
Go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-871-1543 and use the promo code PATSY, and Mike will offer you free shipping. Once again, that's 800-871-1543, promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and in a little while I'm going to be talking to Stephen Hunter, whose new book is called G-Man, and it follows the saga of former Marine Bob Lee Swagger. And for any of you who have been watching that new television program called The Shooter, it is, of course, based on the book, Stephen Hunter's first book, and I know it's become a very, very popular show, and I think that all of you will find this new book particularly interesting because it, you know, now with this new series, well, it's not a new series, it's a continuing series, it's a family series. It's a, Stephen now needs a whole family tree here in order to keep us all straight. Hi, is Stephen, are you there?
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, great. Well,
yeah,
I was just telling my listeners that, you know, now we need this whole family tree to keep everything thing all organized so we know who everybody is in this saga of the Swagger family.
Well, it wouldn't hurt to have a family tree.
That's for sure.
It's now, I guess, in its fourth generation, and it's just as much a surprise to me as it is a surprise to you.
Wow. When you started off, I don't know if you expected that it would go like this. I mean, there,
I had no idea, believe me.
There you were, just one of those sweet, adorable movie critics, and sitting around all day watching movies, chewing popcorn, and then next thing you know, you become a major, major author. I mean, really, what a career here.
Well, thank you very much. To me, I'll tell you what it felt like. To me, I had no grand plan. I expected very little of myself. I was just really glad that I was able to get some of my words published. And I just went from one thing to the other. It didn't feel like I was on any crusade or any, you know, journey to stardom or whatever. I just would do one thing, and then I'd figure out something else to do, and I'd do that thing. And I'm still doing it all these years later, much to my surprise.
Well, you know, I don't think most of the readers of your book know that you were, of course, I love that you were the chief movie critic for the Washington Post. For what?
I didn't know that either. That's what they said. I had no executive function. I had no idea. I was the chief. I would have pulled a lot more rank if I'd have known that.
Well, you know, they're writing that about you, and I thought, chief, like, you know, were there a lot of little Jimmy Olsons there who'd come up to you and say, hey, chief, what can we do for you now?
No, what they would come up to me and say, hey, Steve, I want your job. I can do it much better than you.
Oh, yeah, well, I don't think so, because you proved that you were a pretty good critic because you won the Pulitzer Prize.
You're very kind. Thank
well,
you,
I mean, and of course, anybody who's ever read any of your critiques knows that you are very literate, and you didn't just need
hard
to use,
to believe, isn't
you,
it?
Yeah, you didn't just need to use tomatoes. I mean, you actually used words to describe film.
Yeah, I actually grew to love the writing more than seeing the movies. And one of the reasons I think I became a movie critic, well, there were a lot of reasons, but one of them was I knew it was the fastest way to the writing. You didn't have to call 25 people. You didn't have to weigh viewpoints against viewpoints and factions against factions. You didn't have to do 1,000 different little things that reporters have to do before they write. You just went to the movie and you came back and wrote. And that was, for me, that was the best possible way to get the most out of what talent I had, and I was very fortunate that it worked out.
Well, and in many ways, it's a dream job. You know, I mean, getting paid.
Yeah, it is a dream job
to watch movies. And where did you watch all these movies? Did you actually go to the building in where was the Washington Post in Washington then? They've moved since.
Yeah, the Washington Post then was at 15th, and I think it was. I can't remember, to be honest.
Yeah,
with
I remember
you.
That
went
building.
There 11. Yeah, and we saw a lot of movies at the MPAA, which was just two blocks away, and they had a very nice screening room. But usually, there's a whole, most people don't know this, but there's a whole system of previews in regular pay movie theaters, and the ad agencies who run the system have lists of people because there are lots of movies that the studios want you to see with an audience, because they think you'll be swayed by the audience enthusiasm. In point of fact, it was usually exactly the opposite. The audience laughed. We were such arrogant little twits. We thought, "But this movie must be really stupid." And so, it didn't really work out the way they wanted it to work. But I did see a lot of movies in regular movie theaters with regular audiences.
Well, it's certainly, I think, when we read your books, we feel that you have some cinematic influences in your books. And I love the new book, which is called G-Man. That the cover, I'm holding it up to the camera here. I have a camera in the studio for podcasts. And it's such a lovely cover, a retro G-Man cover.
Yeah, I think they did a real good job. I was very pleased with that.
Oh, it's great. And, of course, tell us about this book a little bit, because now it takes us – well, first of all, I have to tell everyone, I absolutely love – I love prologues that grab you. And, of course, this prologue is great. And I love books where you open something, a treasure, a box, something – and whoa, and that leads you to the story. And you've done a great job with this story.
Thank you very much. You know what? I had some doubts about that, because you're right. It's an old tradition. Open a secret box, and there are the clues. And I thought, you know, maybe this is a little corny. You know, it's like a trope of the 19th century. But since it was a kind of an old-fashioned story I was telling, I thought it would be okay. And so far, Nobody has complained, though you are the first person to have really gotten that, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. So I had fun with that, knowing what an old and hackneyed device it was. It's still, the reason it's hackneyed is because it's a good device. It's a wonderful way to start a story because it organizes the story, it sets the story up, it tells the reader what he's going to get, and it evokes the themes of the story. And it is a terrific, I mean, I'm not complimenting myself, I'm just talking about the idea is a very solid idea. It's a very good craft idea.
It is, and it works, and particularly with this book. And then everything is just from that moment on, we know we are in for a great ride with a really great storyteller. And, you know, there's so many aspects of your writing that I really love. One of them, of course, are guns. And I grew up in northern Michigan, Upper Peninsula, where, you know, it's the land of the guns. Everybody's got a gun. I love books where they talk about guns. Well, any of these, you know, thrillers, international thrillers where they're talking about guns. But you are really so good at it. I mean, you describe guns so well, and you have such a deep understanding. I never quite understood where that came from, because I know that you come from a family of, like, your mother was a writer, your father was a professor, but you come out with all this gun stuff.
Well, I the only thing I could say is that it seems to be kind of genetic, in that I knew when I was 4 years old, when I first saw a gun, I knew that it was my life. I mean, I knew then that I felt fascination, attraction, curiosity. I wanted to know what, where, how. I wanted to know all about it. And that feeling has driven me literally for at least 65 years, and it's never abated. Sometimes it goes away for a little while if I get involved in a different project, but it always returns, and it's really led me to have a fabulous life. I mean, I am probably the most content author you've ever had on. I've just had a great life, and I've met people, and I've gone places, and I've had experiences, and in the gun world, and it's just all been good for me. And one of my ideas when I started writing these books was, I'm going to try and get the gun stuff right, because as you know, most of the stuff you see on TV is nonsense, and I wanted to try and bring a level of accuracy and realism, and at the same time, respect and understanding to the world of firearms that was not available anywhere else. And again, it seems to have paid off for me.
It does. And in the hands of Bob Lee Swager and everybody else in his family, it seems, you certainly have given us a vision of what can be done with guns on the good side, because, of course, Bob Lee is, wow, what a character you came out with.
Well, thank you so much.
And of course, now this book goes back in time to Charles Swager. So
his grandfather, I take his grandfather, I put his grandfather in the FBI in 1934 and take him through that year. And it's through his eyes and through his experiences that we see both the greatness and the sadness, the tragedy and the triumph of that very interesting year.
And I think you had to do quite a bit of research into that era guns, because that's quite different from what Bob Lee's been up to.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it was, I aspire to a kind of higher historical accuracy, and I do have a researcher, a very good friend of mine, and he gives me extremely detailed notes and chronologies and information, and all of that is extremely useful to me, And I feel, I just feel like I've prospered since I've started using him.
Well, I like that that particular scene, the long memo to Purvis about, you know, eliminating the box concept of a shooting range. Tell us a little bit about that scene. I like that.
Thank you very much. And that that plays later in the book. I don't like to introduce something and then not use it. So if I introduce something early, you can count on it showing up later.
And it does. It does. Oh, wow. You know, so the whole book, the story of what is discovered in the prologue, just it pays off one after another. You have a wonderful way of moving the story along, I can tell you.
I could be interviewed by you for the rest of my life. Can we just keep this going forever?
Oh, I can. I think I could talk to you forever because one of the things I wanted to ask you, what is your own personal favorite handgun?
Of the books?
No, not books. Of gun. Your own personal favorite handgun.
You know, I'm attracted to, and I've always been attracted to Thompson submachine guns. Finally, a few years ago, I went through the whole class 3 dance. As you know, it's very complicated and time-consuming. But I now own a Thompson M1A1. And I just, you know, I believe it. I mean, it was a war-issue gun. If you look at it carefully, you'll see it's all nicked on the inside left side. And I realize that's because a guy on patrol was carrying at his hip, and the gun was banging against his canteen and bayonet and his ammunition packages on his belt. And so I know the gun was used in combat. And I don't shoot it that much because you shoot, the guns are not cheap. And if you shoot it, it's like ripping up $5 bills. So I just don't feel comfortable shooting it. But I just love to look at it. I love the whole think about what it's done, where it's been, who jumped into Normandy, who jumped into Sicily with it, you know, just the places it's been. And it's a very, it's one of the things that I think people who don't get guns don't understand the degree to which they are laden with and electric with history. And that's a great pleasure in the gun world, is contemplating these things that we know by serial number have had fabulous careers and been and done fabulous things and interesting things and significant things. And you can just get such a roar out of that. It's amazing and extremely pleasurable.
Well, tell me, first of all, I don't know if you'd get hired by the Washington Post nowadays with this love for guns. But Hollywood has taken you on in a big way. And I was wondering, you know, when Hollywood first approached you, were they like afraid of you because, you know, you're such a film critic that you would be critical of everything?
There were rumors that I always carried 3 guns. And almost on the first day, I didn't have the nerve to do this, but I almost showed up in jungle camouflages with a helmet, but I didn't. And the truth is, I got along very well on the Post. I have good friends there, and I like to think that I represented the positive side of gun culture for people. I think it's gone back. But at least while I was there, I think that I was able to show them that if you like guns, you weren't necessarily a Neanderthal. And although it turns out Neanderthals were smarter than Cro-Magnon, so maybe I should say you weren't necessarily a Cro-Magnon. Anyway, I had a good time at the Washington Post, and they treated me very well. And I'm not crazy with the leftward veer of the Post and all the other big papers, but they're good-hearted people who need to be saved from themselves. That's my. I don't hate them at all. I want them to see the higher truth and do a better job is my position on newspapers these days.
Well, and also you were very popular. You had a name, and I don't know. Did you ever feel like that you could make, or did you ever get sort of I don't want to say egotistical, but that I could make a movie, I could break a movie?
No.
It's
particularly, it maybe in the early years when I was at the Baltimore Sun, but once the internet penetrated life, the voice of the movie critic diminished in influence. I was the film critic there all through the 80s, no internet. I felt that the critic's voice was important in the city, and I had feedback that indicated as much. And once the internet came in, that impact, for better or worse, and I'm not sure it was necessarily for worse, for my ego it was somewhat for the worse, but who cares about that? Now criticism is democratic. Anybody, if you've got a keyboard, you're a movie critic, and so you get a sort of a much less elitist and a lot more populist sense of what movies, what people like in the movies. Again, I don't know if that's for good or bad, but it is significantly different, and it's there's not really much point, I guess, in deciding whether it's good or bad, because whichever it is what it is, and it's going to be that way for forever, I think, or for a long time, at least. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but no, if I did it one time, Phil, I could make or break a movie. I was was relieved of that pressure towards the end.
Well, I think the viewers on television have really found the Shooter, which of course is based on your first book, has turned out to be a pretty good success, and I know that they've done they've renewed it, and I think it will bring a lot of readers to you who had not, heard about the books before, and I think they will find a lot of fun in it. And with this new book, G-Man, which of course is out now and people can get it, and it's very exciting for you. And this was your 10th book, right, in the series, and you're going to be I'm sure you've already working on the 11th.
Yeah, you're absolutely wrong about that. I'm not sure what my next one will be, and I'm looking for a good idea. I've got several, some better than others, but I want to get through the publication of this book before I settle down and get busy.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to it. It'll probably take you about a year, and then you'll be back on here. Meanwhile, do you have a webpage that you like people to go to?
I'm on Facebook.
Yeah, you're on Facebook.
I might have a website, but I don't want it.
You're not
know what to say.
Not a big thing. So
no, I'm really not that big on that stuff.
I don't blame you. It gets exhausting. It gets exhausting, I can tell you. But really, people can find you on Facebook once they know your name, and I want to repeat it. It is, it's just wonderful when people repeat your name a few times during an interview, because people say, oh, I forgot the name. So I'm saying Stephen Hunter. Hunter is easy to remember because he likes guns. And, what more can you ask for, right?
That's absolutely right.
Okay. Well, I think you're going to have a great success with G-Man. It is a good book. One of these books that once you start it, as I said, once you read that prologue, you don't want to put it down, and you carry us right through from the time. I like the way it goes from present day, with Bob, and then we're, going back to his grandfather's legacy and finding out what was going on back then. And it's fascinating. Okay. Well,
thank you so much, Patsy. This has been a good interview. I'm very pleased.
Well, thank you. I'm full of compliments for somebody who writes things that I just love. And as I said, between the guns and the history, because this one I particularly love the history because I'm always fascinated by the 1920s and 1930s. I think you've done a great job. Okay. Are you still there? We're running out of time. Okay. Yeah, they dropped us. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Okay. New York. I'm going to tell Stephen about you. Okay. Anyway, it was fun to talk to Stephen. I really like him. He's a... His books are great, and I was really happy that I've been watching the series. I don't watch a lot of television, but I do like this series. And the actor who plays Bob Lee is, what's his name? I can't remember his name right now, but he's good. And I think it's a very well-done series, and you will enjoy it. So it's going to be back. They did one season, and they just signed up for the second season. And I think you will enjoy the series, and you will definitely enjoy Stephen Hunter's books. You can start with this one because it is actually it's sort of fun to start with this one because it tells the story of his grandfather, which we didn't know about in the earlier books because for a long time no one would talk about the grandfather. And now we know why, and now we understand the story better. And as I said, Stephen has done a great job with this book, and I hope that you will get it. And I also have some exciting news coming up. I have Paula Poundstone, who's going to be on in 2 weeks, so everybody can listen to that. I don't know what she's written yet. I actually do. She's written a book about being happy, and they just sent it to me. They were like late in sending it to me, and I should have it today, and I will read it, but I know that she's going to be fun, and she always has a lot of interesting things to say, so I'm excited to have her on. And I have all through the summer, I have some really great people, and you can go to my website, radio-joyonpaper.com, and you can see my summer reading list there. And I think it'll give you a lot of ideas, books that you can read this summer and just enjoy yourself, relax by the pool, under the trees, in a hammock, wherever you like to read, or inside in a nice air-conditioned area of your house, and just read and enjoy yourself, and go to my list and see the books that I recommend. Meanwhile, remember that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, and nowadays to hear them on stage or screen or in a movie or in an audible book. So as Donna Levin said, you have to write every day, and you will be able to have a book in a year or so, and you never know. You might be on Joy on Paper. And meanwhile, make sure you say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, who is always so sweet, and he's saluting me, and I salute him back. And by the way, Semper Fi to all you Marines out there, and especially to Johnny Clark and his new book, Section 8. And we're going to be talking to him again about that soon. Okay, bye-bye now.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.